I am looking at a very strange and mysterious photograph. It was taken in the Pacific near the equator, not far from the international dateline, and quite clearly it can only be one thing. It is a crashed UFO, partly obscured by foliage. Vines are growing over it, big and sinister. Well, yes, it is a UFO, but that stands for unpleasant foreign object, and I'm about to tell you the story of this ghastly thing and the very dangerous cargo it contains. It's important to remember that between 1946 and 1958, the US used the Marshall Islands as a sort of a bowling alley for nuclear weapons. Would you believe they detonated over 60 A-bombs in the Marshall Islands, most of which exploded over the Inuituq Atoll in the country's northwest. Now, once the testing was over, America dumped the radioactive waste on one of the islands and sealed it inside the UFO, an enormous concrete dome that they built right next to the water. Now, since its construction in 1979, the Runet Dome, as it's known, has fallen into disrepair and is apparently starting to show a few cracks. This month saw reports that the dome was leaking. Scientists are now worried that climate change-induced sea level rises could inundate the structure and cause thousands of cubic metres of nuclear waste to flow into the Pacific Ocean. Now, to discuss the issue, I'm going to speak with Tony DeBrun, who's the Foreign Minister of the Marshall Islands. Tony joins me from the capital, Majuro, and with me via Skype is Michael Gerard. Michael is the Director of the Sabin Centre for Climate Change Law at Columbia, and I welcome you both. Tony, I couldn't help but overhear a conversation you were having with Michael as we were preparing to go to air, and you were talking about the fact that you've got a fishing boat in your garden. As this is a part of the story, the amazing weather events that you're suffering, would you mind telling us why you've got a fishing boat in your garden?
Well, when we had the storm over 3 weeks ago that hit Majuro, many of the fishing boats in the lagoon broke anchor and drifted ashore. One of them, which was right out in front of my house, came all the way to what I call my living room, which is the room that faces the lagoon downstairs, where I spend most of my time. Just hit it with the bow and then turned around and went next door and destroyed my sister's dock next door. So thank God it didn't really destroy my house, but it's still here. It's not movable, and our public works people are still trying to figure out a way of throwing it out back to sea.
Well, that's dramatic evidence of one of the things we'll be talking about, and that is the impact of changing weather patterns in your part of the world. Now, Michael, you visited the dreaded dome during a study trip in 2010. How big is it?
It's about 350 feet across and maybe 10 or 15 feet high, right by the sea level.
And it's made of what?
It is made from the crater left behind by one of the atomic bombs, and into it they dumped several hundred thousand cubic yards of plutonium-contaminated material and then covered it over with a thin layer, 18-inch layer of cement.
Michael, did you see any fences or guards or precautionary signs in the vicinity warning people, including your good self, about the dangers of this dump?
No, nothing at all. There are no fences, there are no signs, no guards. There, if you go on the internet, you'll find a photo of a sign, but it's not there. At least it wasn't there when I was there in 2010. Somebody could visit from Mars and have no, or actually somebody could visit from anywhere and have no idea what this thing is.
So the area around the dome, and I can tell this from my photograph, mostly remains uninhabited, but I read that locals still visit the location, Tony, to fish and to salvage for scrap metal.
The island is uninhabited, therefore it would follow that the area around it would be teeming with fish. And so the community of Inuituq and some of the people who live on the other two islands in the lagoon do visit it regularly to fish around the dome, literally around that island called Runic. We have tried to discourage such behavior, but it's really difficult to control people that far away from Nanaimo is 600 miles from capital. So it's a long ship's ride. It is a difficulty trying to ensure that people follow some of the rules that were set before resettlement, including not to visit Burnett Island.
And I am right that there is some market in scrap metal from the area.
That is correct. I mean, not so much ruined because that material is sealed under the concrete dome, but some of the other islands in the lagoon are being visited by diggers. I don't know what else to call them, but people who are digging for copper and the non-ferrous metal scrap. The problem with that is that they're kicking up dust, and that dust is also radioactive.
Michael, you've written that the islands stand out for their misfortunes, ravaged first by radioactivity from tests conducted after World War II and now by rising seas that threaten to swallow it. In the case of the dome, two misfortunes are coming together head-on because locals and scientists are warning that the structural integrity of the dome is being threatened by climate change. How urgent is that threat?
The U.S. government has been studying the dome and has concluded that it is vulnerable to a serious typhoon, and certainly very serious typhoons do hit the Marshall Islands from time to time and with increasing frequency and severity. The irony is that the U.S. government also says it wouldn't matter so much if the dome were to break apart because the radioactive contamination all around it is as serious as the radioactive contamination within it, that the area outside the sediment is already very heavily radioactive from the residue of these dozens of nuclear tests.
Now, I just want to work out some of the politics of this, Tony. I'm well aware that the Marshall Islands have had a long colonial history, the Spanish, the Germans, etc., but you now have a very close relationship, your republic, with the United States of America, and I understand that you use the U.S. dollar as your currency.
Yes, we do. That's part of the agreement, the Contract of Free Association, the use of U.S. currency is included in that document. But I want to say something more about what the professor was just referring to. It was at a meeting with the Department of Energy of the United States where we were told that the contaminants outside of the dome area are as bad as what's in it. I asked the question of the DOE representatives, so why did we build the dome in the first place? Why do we want to gather all this material and put them in a dome when all the surrounding area is already as contaminated or worse contaminated than what's in the dome? We have not received an answer to this point.
I'm fascinated by this problematic relationship you have with the U.S. on many levels. It's friendly, cooperative, and on others you meet this... Well, the dome has its wall of silence.
I started questioning the plan to build that dome even before it was built. I did an interview on the U.S. TV network CBS, a show called 60 Minutes, way back when, and said that we did not think that would be a safe storage for nuclear waste. But the problem here is that the United States is saying the responsibility for the upkeep of that dome is now ours, meaning...
But you're a tiny group. You've got very little money. How could you possibly tackle a project of this magnitude?
We cannot. We cannot afford to. We don't have the technical nor the financial resources to deal with that issue. And we're trying to get the United States to own up to that responsibility. Please understand, our relationship with the United States is warm and friendly. But the issue of nuclear legacy remains an open wound that needs to be addressed. We have requested information to help us make informed decisions as to what to do with contaminated areas. But to this day, that information is being withheld from us based on U.S. security requirements.
My guests are Tony DeBrumm, who's the Foreign Minister of Marshall Islands, and Michael Gerard, who we're talking to in New York. Michael, it's interesting that we're having this discussion and that this is becoming a major crisis on the anniversary of the Hiroshima bombing, the 70th anniversary.
And that the anniversary marks the beginning of the nuclear age where, as you said, the U.S. dropped a large number of nuclear weapons, as did several other countries, and we are going to be living with a legacy of that for a very long time.
We were a bomb test place too, Australia, and quite a few bombs were dropped here, and with long-term problems for the indigenous population. So it's a story that resonates with your Australian friends. Michael, a journalist who visited the sites in 2008 said that there were cracks in the structure deep enough for birds to lay their eggs in. Okay, I take the point that doesn't matter much whether the damn thing does crack it. The problem exceeds the dome. But has anyone tried to effect repairs on this wretched thing in the last few decades?
You know, they go there every few years and patch up the cracks a bit, but that is not accomplishing very much. A couple of years ago, the United States Congress called for the U.S. Department of Energy to do a study. They did the study, the first phases of it, that do show its structural vulnerability, but there is no plan for actually coping with it in any serious way, at least no plan that has been made public.
Tony, you talked about this deal that you struck, that your country struck with the U.S. at the time. I understand that as a part of the agreement, the U.S. offered a measly $150 million trust fund, quote, in full and final settlement of all past and future claims deriving from nuclear tests. Gosh, you were a bargain, but of course that measly fund has long since been exhausted.
That is correct. That amount was set in consultation with our negotiating team, based on assurances of the United States in a report they issued in 1978, saying that the extent of the damage from the nuclear testing could be covered by that amount of money. We had no other way of making an informed decision on that issue except to take their word for it. They're the only ones with the information. They're the only ones with the technology. They're the only ones with the wherewithal to deal with that legacy. So we had no choice but to accept that deal, because without that deal, termination of the trusteeship would not have occurred. In other words, independence would have been denied the Marshall Islands had that deal not been accepted.
You were just 9, Tony, when you witnessed the explosion of Castle Bravo, the most powerful H-bomb ever detonated by the U.S., and you're now spearheading an ambitious lawsuit against the U.S. at the International Court of Justice. Tell us about that.
Let me say this about I saw Bravo, but I also saw many other shots. Bravo was the most horrific. Bravo was extremely, it still sticks in my mind when I talk about it now that I'm 70 years old. 61 years later, I still get goosebumps. I have a memory of that shot that will not be erased. But on the lawsuit issue, the lawsuit is filed in conjunction with the Non-Proliferation Treaty, that the atomic powers agreed in Title VI to negotiate disarmament. And that's what the lawsuit is about. It's about living up to the treaty requirements that they sit down and negotiate disarmament. Other issues pertaining to the remnants of the testing period, the physical injuries to the people and the property damages that occurred are still ongoing. We're still trying to find a way to revisit the issue based on assurances by the United States that if new circumstances were discovered that would affect the decision in 1986 to terminate the trusteeship based on the nuclear claims agreement, then we could revisit the issue. That's what we're trying to do now. But the lawsuit in the ICJ is a completely different issue. It's about living up to treaty obligations. And we, as people who are exposed to nuclear testing, really do not want this to ever occur on other people in the world, ever. So that is the purpose of the exercise.
Michael, given your role as director of the Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia, what climate change law is there available for the international community, let alone the Marshall Islanders, to use as leverage?
Well, it's very limited. Of course, the most important thing for the Marshall Islands or for the entire world is that there be a very significant reduction in the greenhouse gas emissions that are causing this problem in the first place. In 1992, the United Nations negotiated an international framework convention. So far, it hasn't accomplished a great deal. This December in Paris is the next big meeting of the UN convention in with the hopes that we will come to a new international agreement to significantly reduce greenhouse gas emissions and slow down the rising of the seas and all the other terrible problems that climate change causes.
We've done any number of programs over the years on the impact of climate change already on various societies, cultures, countries in the Pacific, with their groundwater being undermined by already a sufficient rise in ocean levels. But I ask you this, do you have solid evidence, Michael, that there is leakage of the domes or the Americans' plutonium into the Pacific?
Yes, the Department of Energy study that was just performed documents how the groundwater levels rise and fall with the tide inside the dome. So it's clear that there is communication of the water outside the dome and inside the dome.
Tony, what has been the long-term health effects on your people? I know that, in a strange way, the tests affected diabetes because, of course, fishing was problematic for a while, so there were dietary changes which weren't helpful. But is there long-term evidence of radiation sickness in any way, in any form, for your people?
Well, absolutely. We have a continuing program of monitoring people that the United States admits were exposed to radioactive material during the testing program. People of Aniwetak and Bikini and people of Rongelap and Utrud are still being monitored. And there is, in fact, a marked difference in the occurrence of cancers and other related anomalies from the testing. There's no question about that. The issue of diet is not merely a problem of not being able to eat. It's displacement. When these people are moved away from their land, they live in strange places that they had never lived before, their whole lifestyle changes. They become more dependent on imported foods and starches than they have been before in the natural setting of their homeland. So that may have a direct effect on diet and diabetes, as you say. But the health of the Marshallese people as a whole has been affected by the testing. And the United States itself predicted that more than 250 cases of cancer would occur in this decade from islands that are listed as non-exposed by the United States government.
This is the most appalling story. Gentlemen, I thank you very much for your time. Tony de Bruin, Minister of Foreign Affairs for the Marshall Islands, and Professor Michael Gerard, the director of the Sabine Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia University. Tony and Michael, a privilege to talk to you, but I must say, hardly a pleasure. LNL on RN.